From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the songwriting team behind the hits You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', On Broadway, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and others. We talk with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. They're now performing many of those songs in the new show They Wrote That, now in previews off Broadway. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Company, the new movie by Robert Altman. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Halliburton, the company formerly led by Vice President Dick Cheney, said today that it has sent a $6.3 million check to the Pentagon to pay for potential overcharges. A company spokeswoman said some of its employees may have taken bribes to allow a Kuwaiti supplier to overcharge for fuel that was shipped to Iraq. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said today that the Pentagon is investigating.
There are a lot of safeguards that have been put in place in the contracting process. We expect those safeguards to be followed. And I think that that is exactly what is happening now because the Department of Defense is moving forward to look into that matter and to get to the bottom of it.
Halliburton is the largest contractor in Iraq with work that could be worth as much as $8 billion. A U.S. military helicopter crashed today in northern Iraq, killing its two pilots. The helicopter was attached to the Army's 101st Airborne Division. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
The Kiowa Warrior helicopter was traveling some 30 miles south of Mosul, where the 101st is based, when it went down. The cause of the crash is under investigation. The Kiowa is an armed reconnaissance helicopter whose primary mission is to locate and maintain contact with the enemy. And the Army said in an initial report that the pilots of a second Kiowa that accompanied the downed aircraft did not report seeing any hostile activity. It was the fourth helicopter crash in Iraq this month. A Kiowa and a Black Hawk were shot down earlier this month in separate attacks, killing 10 U.S. soldiers. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
David Kaye is stepping down as the head of the U.S. search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Kaye, who led the search since the fall of Saddam Hussein, told Reuters he now believes that Iraq never acquired stockpiles of banned weapons after the 1991 Gulf War. The state Supreme Court of Illinois has ruled former Governor George Ryan did have the authority to commute the sentences of all death row inmates just days before he left office. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
George Ryan cleared death row last January, saying the wrongful convictions and exonerations of 13 death row inmates showed the state's death penalty system was flawed. Ryan pardoned four men and commuted the death sentences of 167 others. But the Illinois Attorney General challenged the constitutionality of the blanket commutations. Despite the argument, the state Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Ryan did not overstep his authority. Rob Warden, the executive director of Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions, says it was the right decision.
And we are delighted that the Illinois Supreme Court has finally and firmly put this matter to rest.
Earlier this week, the state's current governor signed the final piece of a massive set of Illinois death penalty reforms. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
The Dow lost 54 points to close at 10,568. The NASDAQ was up 4 to 21,23. This is NPR News. Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt says he's releasing his Democratic convention delegates to support other candidates. Gephardt, who withdrew from the race for the Democratic presidential nomination after a disappointing finish in the Iowa caucuses, said he won't endorse another candidate before February 3rd, the date of the primary in his home state of Missouri. Bob Keeshan, TV's Captain Kangaroo for more than 30 years, has died. Keeshan's family says he died after a long illness. He was 76 years old. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Now, boys and girls, CBS Television presents Captain Kangaroo and his treasure house.
Starting the morning with Captain Kangaroo was a ritual for generations of American children, and the man in the red jacket and walrus mustache left a lasting influence on television. Keeshan started his TV career as a receptionist, but when the Howdy Doody show drafted him to play Claribel the Clown, he made such an impression he became a regular. When Bob Keeshan premiered Captain Kangaroo in 1955, he made waves by not including children on the show. Instead, he spoke directly to them through the camera. Keeshan, a former Marine, was always concerned about violence and racial stereotyping on kids' TV, and he became a fervent advocate for children's education, writing books and giving concerts intended to help kids appreciate classical music and jazz. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
NASA says it has begun receiving limited information from the ailing Spirit rover on Mars. The project manager says the rover's computer appears to be having a software problem that causes it to start up, discover a problem, and then shut itself down over and over again. He says it could take days or weeks to fix the problem. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AAAS and its journal, Science, advancing science, serving society, and promoting science literacy, on the web at aaas.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guests, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, have been a songwriting team, as well as husband and wife, for about four decades. Their hits include On Broadway, Uptown, Only in America, Kicks, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and this song.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it.
Terry Gross spoke with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil in 2000. Now the music and career of this songwriting team is being presented in They Wrote That, an off-Broadway review starring the composers themselves. It's now in previews and opens next month. When Mann and Weil teamed up in the early 60s, they were both staff writers for a music publishing company owned by Don Kirshner. They worked in Manhattan in an office near the Brill Building, where the area was the new Tin Pan Alley. That's where they and songwriters like Carole King, Jerry Goffin, Ellie Greenwich, and Neil Sedaka churned out material for the latest singers and pop groups. Unlike many songwriters of the 60s, Mann and Weil survived the British invasion. At the end of 1999, Mann and Weil's song You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin' was the most performed song of the century in the BMI publishing catalog.
Baby, baby, I'd get down on my knees for you.
Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Barry Mann, let me ask you first, what's happening in the melody of that song? Is there anything that you worked on that is particularly interesting to describe?
Oh, I don't know if it would be interesting now, but when we wrote the song, it was very different for its time. That middle part of the song, the soulful part, had never been done before. And also at the time, the record ran long, which for nowadays, it's really short. It ran over 3 minutes. And so Phil Spector, who produced the record, even though it was, I think it was he put 258 on it, even though I think it ran around 310 or so. So that's about the only difference I can talk about now.
Oh, so he lied about the length so he didn't play it.
Uh-huh. Yes.
When you say that part of the melody hadn't ever been done before, which part are you referring to? Maybe you can hum it for us.
You know, where they go, boom, boom, boom. You know, baby, baby, I get down on my knees for you. It kind of, for that period, I think it was kind of very different to come out with something like that in a ballad.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia Weil, what was the part of the lyric that came to you first that you built everything else around?
You know, Barry started playing that opening melody, and I'm not sure which one of us. As a matter of fact, I think it was Barry who came up with the opening line, "You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips." And it just seemed to flow, and when we hit the chorus, one of us, I think it was me, sang out, "You've lost that love and feeling," and we weren't even thinking of using it as the real title. I mean, in those days, we used to write a song and kind of just fill it up with any words just so we'd remember it. And we used to call that a dummy title or a dummy lyric. And that was our dummy lyric. And then we wrote a verse and a chorus, and we called Phil, and we played it for him. And he said, "That's not the dummy lyric. That's the lyric."
Now, that's the title, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, Phil Spector has a co-writing credit on "You've Lost That Love and Feeling." What did he add?
Well, it was his suggestion to come up with that middle part, which was a terrific suggestion. And you know, after we did play the verses and the choruses, he then joined in and continued to.
We wrote the rest of the song together.
And also, he produced an incredible record. For its time.
So were you writing the song on assignment? Were you writing it for the Righteous Brothers?
Yes.
Yeah, we were living in New York at the time, and Phil, we had worked a little bit with Phil, and he wanted us to come out and work with him in L.A., and he played us a record of these two singers out of Orange County, and they had two local hits. One was called "My Babe," and the other was "Little Latin Loopy Lou," and he said, you know, just let's think of a way to go with them. That's interesting. I want to record them for my label. And we were very inspired by the Four Tops, and "Baby, I Need Your Lovin'" was our favorite song of the time because it had this really raw passion that we wanted to capture for the Righteous Brothers. And when we wrote the song, they weren't that crazy about it.
Really?
Well, when I sang it, I loved the Everly Brothers at the time, and I sounded like the Everly Brothers. So when I sang it to Bill and Bobby, they said, you know, this is really good, very good for the Everly Brothers. And another thing that happened is that at the time, you know, the records that they had been putting out, they both sang together. And this one, Bill Medley, had the lead. So Bobby said, well, what am I going to do while he sings? And I think Phil Spector says, well, you'll be walking to the bank. So
Phil was quite confident in his abilities.
Give us a sense of the process. When you became a songwriting team, were you assigned which singers you would be writing for back when you were working for Don Kirshner?
It went both ways. We could just sit and write a song, or there were assignments. The Drifters would be up, say, as a group, and everybody at all the music would run to write for the Drifters. But at the same time, there were songs we just sat down to write. When we originally, Cynthia and I wrote the original, there was an original version of On Broadway, and I always had the concept to try to write a Gershwin-esque kind of contemporary song, and that's basically how On Broadway was written, and the reason for it. Again, there was no specific artist in mind. So it happened all different ways.
Okay, let's stick with On Broadway for a minute. This was a big hit for the Drifters. Mm-hmm. You had nobody particular in mind when you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Drifters have the first recording of it?
Yes.
That was released.
Yeah.
But it actually, Carol and Jerry were recording a group, right?
This is Carol King and Jerry Garland.
Yeah, but also Phil Spector cut our original version of On Broadway with, I think, the Crystals.
Yeah.
He never completed it. As a matter of fact, I have it at home. I should have brought it here. It would have been very, very interesting to hear.
Now, how did that version compare to the one the Drifters did?
Melodically, it was very, very close. The opening line, instead of "They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway," ours is "They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway." Bright is very Gershwin-y, kind of, you know, kind of more of a bluesy note.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was changed. Mike Stoller suggested that we change it. And also, we didn't modulate three times, and that was a very good suggestion. And then lyrically, there was a different lyrical perspective. You can talk about it, Cynthia, if you want.
Well, I think we had written it for a girl group. So it was about a girl coming to New York and dreaming of Broadway and stardom. And it was much more kind of escape from a small town, and I'm going to make it. And when we met with Jerry and Mike and played this for them, they said, you know, we're doing the Drifters, so it would need a whole other perspective. And you can go home and do it yourself, or you can write it with us. And these guys were our idols. We thought they were great, and it would be a fantastic opportunity to work with them. So we ended up reworking the song together. Which and it was like going to songwriting school working with Jerry Lieber. It's for me as a lyricist.
Because they have very two different approaches lyrically. Cynthia is much more organized. She would want to write the first verse, make sure it's completed to go to the chorus.
And yeah, I'd stay on that second line. If I couldn't get it, I'd be there for months, you know. I wouldn't move. And Jerry just kind of jumped around and showed me that you can, you know, go different places and move things around. You don't have to be so rigid.
It was a very exciting experience.
Why don't we hear the Drifters' recording of On Broadway, the song written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil.
And
Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller.
Right.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
On Broadway.
But when you're walking
Barry Mann, before we heard this, you mentioned that, I think it was Lieber and Stoller suggested adding the modulations. We mm-hmm. just heard one of those key changes. Mm-hmm. What does that kind of key change do to the emotional quality of a song?
Well, especially in that song, it really works because that song is basically one melody. It's a verse that's repeated three times. So it would really get very boring to just do the same melody three times in the same key. So that really uplifted the song.
My guests are songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. They've been married and a songwriting team since the early 60s. One of the types of groups that you work for was the girl groups. You wrote a few girl group hits, including mm-hmm. a couple for the Crystals, Uptown and He's Sure the Boy I Love.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any considerations lyrically, writing for the girl groups? Was a certain type of lyric, certain type of song?
You know, there were, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich really were the quintessential girl group writers. They were really into lots of sounds, and I was never really good at that. I somehow felt that my girls group lyrics, except for Walking in the Rain, which was really adolescent, were kind of, I was trying to be adolescent, and I didn't know how very well, and they were just a little sharper. I mean, Uptown certainly is not a girls' group song. It's sung by a girls' group, but that's the only thing. It was one of the first sociological songs, and I just don't think that I was really a good girls' group songwriter.
I mean, if I could just kind of interject, when I first started writing with Cynthia, first she showed me some of her lyrics, and I really liked them a lot. And what I saw in them was this, they had a show quality to them. There was a sophistication, and I really thought that sophistication combined with rock and roll would be very fresh. And I think Cynthia always has kept that kind of sophistication, unless she really had to go sideways, which was like walking in the rain. And it was a great combination.
Well, Uptown kind of tells a story. What's the story it tells?
Well, it really tells a story of a man who, because of his race, is regarded one way in the workplace and then another way with his friends and family and the woman who loves him. That song had a story to it also, in that when we had written it and Phil had recorded it, I think there were a couple of notes that Phil had changed because the singer couldn't hit them. And we went nuts. You know, we were so young and insane that those things really mattered. And one note could drive both of us over the edge. And we begged him to come in and record it again with another singer that we had found who happened to be Carole King and Jerry Goffin's babysitter named Eva.
And little Eva.
That's right.
Who did the locomotion.
Exactly. Right. So before little Eva did the locomotion, we dragged her into a studio with Phil, and it was the first time she'd ever been on mic, and Phil was driving her crazy, and she didn't realize that when she was on the mic, even if we weren't recording, you could hear what she was saying in the control booth. And so she was ranting about hating Phil during the whole thing. And he was enjoying it so much. And when she finished, we realized that Phil had made the better record anyway, and he really just was humoring us to do this. It was very sweet of him to do it.
Humoring us and torturing her.
Yes, exactly. But then Eva, of course, went on to become Little Eva.
Well, let's hear the Crystals' hit version of Uptown.
He gets up each morning and he goes downtown, where everyone's his boss and he's lost in an angry land. He's a little man, but then he comes uptown each evening to my tenement. Uptown where folks don't have to pay much rent. And when he's there with me, he can see that he's everything. Then he's tall, he don't crawl, he's a king. Downtown, he's just one of a million guys. He don't get no breaks, and he takes all they got to give. He's got to live. But then he comes uptown where he can hold his head up high. Uptown he knows that I'll be standing by. And when I take his hand, there's no man who could put him down. The world is sweet, it's at his feet when he's uptown.
Uptown, written by my guests Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Was it Phil Spector who came up with that real Latin-sounding instrumentation, the castanets?
Yes. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, that was Phil.
Did you have that in mind at all? Were you surprised when you hear it, when you heard it?
No, we had nothing in mind.
This is one of the few songs that we did not have a demo on, a demonstration record in which you kind of lay out the song for the producer with musical instruments and everything. We had played this song for a man named Artie Ripp, who was working at Alden Music as kind of a song plugger, and he loved it so much that he learned how to play it on the piano himself, and he played and sang it for Phil Spector, who then just took it and recorded it. Thing we knew, we had a record.
I think I did a piano voice demo for him just to have something to guide.
But there was no real concept given to Phil. This was all Phil.
Now, let me ask you about another song that you wrote, Only in America, and Jay and the Americans had the hit of this. I understand the original version was actually written for the Drifters.
It was, and it was recorded by the Drifters. But then when they brought these around to disc jockeys, the black disc jockeys, they wouldn't play it because they felt that the lyric was a lie. You know, and very interesting, this little quick concept that we almost did. It wasn't really serious, but we almost wrote it the opposite way, and I would have loved to have done it. And that period was like, only in America, where they preach a golden rule, do they start to march when my kids try to go to school. Only in America, land of opportunity, do they save a seat in the back of the bus just for me. Which I thought was really very, it was very harsh, but
that was the way we wanted to go.
So you wanted to go like a civil rights protest song.
Exactly. And Jerry Lieber, who was the voice of reason, said, you'll never get this play. Don't waste your time. We have to think positively, and we have to write it from another viewpoint.
So basically, we wrote it from a really white viewpoint, which was, you know, valid for someone who was white. And they ended up, by the way, taking that Drifters track and putting Jane and the Americans onto that track.
So the lyric you ended up with is very kind of positive. Only in America,
yes,
land of opportunity, can a rich girl like you fall for a poor boy like me.
Yes, yes.
So you say that the Jay and the Americans version had the Drifters
track.
Well, Lieber and Stoller produced both the Drifters and Jay and the Americans. So after they took the Drifters' voices off, they put Jay and the Americans on.
I see. How did the Drifters feel when the song was taken away from them because it was felt that a black group really couldn't sing a song about how great America was be believable?
I don't know. We never discussed it with them, but I'm sure that they felt a sense of hypocrisy singing the song at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. Here's the Jay and the Americans version of Only in America. I'm David B. Inculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire. Only in America can a kid without a cent get a break and maybe grow. Giant step and reach right up and touch the stars. In America, could a dream like this come true? Could a guy like me start with nothing and end up with you?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from the Sundance Channel, Anatomy of a Scene explores the making of the 2003 Sundance Film Festival premiere 28 days later, tonight at 8:30 p.m. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
That's Barry Mann singing one of the songs he wrote with Cynthia Weil. Coming up, Mann and Weil tell us about surviving 40 years as a songwriting team and married couple. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Company, the new Robert Altman film.
Down that street, and you ain't had enough to eat. The glitter rubs right off, and you're nowhere. They say the women treat you fine on Broadway, but look.
you're gonna make some time when all you got is one thin dime, and one thin dime won't even shine your shoes. They say that I won't last too long on Broadway.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, back with the songwriting team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. They've been married and writing songs together since the early 60s. They're now appearing as a team on stage, performing their own compositions in an off-Broadway review called They Wrote That. It's in previews and opens next month. Their hits include You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling, On Broadway, Uptown, Only in America, Kicks, and We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
As songwriters in the 1960s, you first wrote for, you know, the vocal groups of the day, like the Drifters, the girl groups like the Crystals, you know, heartthrobs, teen idols. And then, like, the Beatles came along and the whole British invasion and bands started writing their own songs. Mm-hmm. And certainly, like, after Dylan, singer-songwriters became really popular. You were expected to write your own material for the most part. Mm-hmm. Yet you managed to have a British invasion hit with the Animals, We Gotta Get mm-hmm. Out of This Place, which was mm-hmm. a very big hit. How did you end up writing for them?
Again, we didn't write for them. We wrote that song specifically for the Righteous Brothers, and we cut a demo that was tailored for the Righteous Brothers.
Oh.
And at the time, we were being represented by Alan Klein, who represented a producer named Mickey Most. Mickey Most produced the Animals, and we forgot. I even forgot that we gave Alan the song for Mickey Most. And I had this demo that I sang on, and it was such a good demo that I was also on Lieber and Stoller's record label, Redbird, that the demo was so great that we were about to put it out as a single for myself. And just that week we were supposed to put it out, Don Kirshner called us up and told us that the Animals had released it, and it was number two in England at the time.
So you didn't even know?
No.
So that killed your record, huh?
Absolutely.
No. Were you disappointed that your record wasn't going to be released, or really glad because another group had a really big hit with it?
We were crushed.
Yeah, especially Cynthia.
I was really upset. The Animals had left out parts of the lyric, and, you know, they had made a great record for the Animals and done what they should have done for themselves, but they had, you know, changed lyric, and I felt, you know, I had compromised the song in certain ways.
What didn't they do that you had written? How did they change
well,
it?
Well, if you listen to Barry's version on Soul Inspiration, his album, you will hear the way it was written, and you can hear the difference.
And the lyric.
Yeah. I mean, just play one after the other, and it's pretty striking.
Well, why don't we do that? Why don't we hear the Animals version followed by the Barry Mann version from the new CD, Soul and Inspiration, and compare the two.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due, I know. Watch my daddy in bed and crying, watch his hand been turning gray. He's been working and slaving his life.
this dirty part of the city where the sun forgets to shine. People say there just ain't no use in trying. There ain't no use in trying. Whoa, girl, now you're young and oh so pretty. Staying here would be a crime. Cause you just grow old before your time. Yes, you will, girl, I know that you will. Oh, I know it, yeah. Yeah, I know it, yeah. I say yeah.
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 Yeah. I can't take it no more. What are we waiting for? We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Cause girl, there's a better life for me and you.
Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil. Now that it's been years since The Animals hit, and now Barry Mann, you have this new version on your CD, Soul and Inspiration. Which one do you prefer now? Still like the original better?
You know, it's like apples and oranges, really. I like my version only because it kind of projects the way I had originally written it. And the Animals version really has its charm. I won't accept charm.
I cast my vote for the Barry Mann version.
Oh, well, thank you, honey. That's very nice of you. I mean, Animals, truthfully, the Animals look, they were like from a coal mining town, you know, so that it really kind of has that kind of quality to it, a very raw coal mining rawness to it that mine doesn't have.
Well, yours has raw Brooklyn.
All right. That's right. You know what I'm saying?
You're raw from Flatbush.
That's right.
What are some of the surprising contexts that you have heard this song performed in?
Well, the fact that it became an anthem in Vietnam was amazing to us and very moving. And
we're friendly with David Kennelly, you know, who the photographer who won the Pulitzer Prize for Vietnam photojournalism, and he told us that it was that song meant a lot to the GIs over there.
My guests are songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. So after the British invasion and after, you know, Bob Dylan, when singer-songwriters and bands writing their own songs became really popular, who did you write for that you weren't writing for before? I mean, what kind of changes did you have to make in your lives as professional songwriters?
Yeah, I think the biggest change melodically that happened was that songs became more guitar-oriented as opposed to keyboard-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to try to think a little bit more guitar-y, even though it's very difficult to do. So we did, I would sometimes come up with bass riffs or a guitar riff on the piano to begin songs. And an example, matter of fact, is We Gotta Get Out of This Place. It's a bass riff that really starts the song off. And the song Kicks, that Paul Revere and the Raiders sang. Mm-hmm. It's a guitar-oriented record. Same thing with Hungry. And Kicks also started off with a bass riff. So that was a very big change.
But it seems to me that throughout our careers, to be completely honest with you, every time something new happened, we were sure this was the end. And, you know, I mean, the first end was when the British invasion happened, and we were sure this is it, our careers are over. I remember when disco came in, we thought it was all over. There just have been so many times and so many fads that we thought our songs are not going to be happening anymore. And yet somehow we always seem to either just keep doing what we were doing and it came into style again, or else adapt just a little bit, and we were able to our careers were able to continue through the 70s and 80s and 90s. It just but it was not as easy as it looked, because there were plenty of times where we felt that it wasn't going to continue.
Why don't we hear one of your hits from the 70s, and this is a Dolly Parton recording, mm-hmm. of Here You Come Again. Did you intend this to be a country song?
No, I just wrote a song. As a matter of fact, I think that one we had B.J. Thomas in mind.
We did write it for B.J.
Thomas, yeah.
And how did Dolly Parton end up recording it?
I think one of the publishers, our publisher at the time, brought it to Dolly Parton, and she ended up recording it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think she recorded it. I had recorded it myself. I had a deal on Arista Records. As you'll see throughout my career, I've had many record deals.
I think we once counted 13 labels.
But anyway, my version was really very good. It was very, very similar to the Dolly Parton record. As a matter of fact, Dean Parks, who was the guitar player on my record, ended up doing the arrangement for Dolly. And so it's very, very similar.
Well, let's hear her 1977 hit.
Right in the door, just like you've done before, and wrap my heart round your little finger. Here you come again, just when I'm about to make it work without you. You look into my eyes and lie those pretty lies, and pretty soon I'm wondering.
Dolly Parton singing a song written by my guests, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Barry Mann, you've tried to make it as a singer, but so far you've been a huge success as a songwriter, not so huge as a singer. However, very, very early in your career, you did have a big hit,
yes.
Who Put the Bomb?
Bomb
and the Bomb Shabomb Shabomb? That was co-written with Jerry Goffin. I guess that was before you and Cynthia Weil hooked up.
We were writing at the same time.
Okay.
But I think that song kind of kicked off the whole sociological movement.
It was
Dylan really got it. Was inspired by Who Put the Bump. You know that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, this is the kind of song that adults would make fun of. Like, what do these lyrics mean? They don't mean anything. It's just nonsense rhymes. This rock and roll.
See, that's where the adults didn't get it. I was making fun of it. That song was a spoof. On those songs.
On songs like Ramalama Ding Dong.
That's right.
Yeah, it was satire. And I think, you know, the kids who bought the record took it seriously, and the adults just thought it was dumb.
Yeah. And it became a hit.
And did you think, well, now I'm really going to make it as a singer?
I would have liked to. You know, it's a very hard song to follow up on. As a matter of fact, I did follow up with a song called Teenage Has-Been. And it was like, it was, again, a spoof on, I think the end of the record it said, I think five people bought my record, my mother, my father, my sister, and my brother. And it was kind of a put on. But, you know, it was a kind of record that they asked me to cut an album afterwards on, after I did Who Put the Bomb, which I didn't want to do because I knew I could it would never sell. And it would only go against the royalties that were going to be that owed to me. And I ended up cutting an album anyway. And, of course, it didn't sell.
Well, why don't we hear the song that did sell? This is Barry Mann singing the song he co-wrote with Jerry Goffin, Who Put the Bomb.
I'd like to thank the guy who wrote the song that made my baby fall in love with me. Who put the bomb in
and the bom 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 bom. Who put the rhyme in the ram-a-lama ding dong? Who put the bop in the bop shabop shabop? Who put the dip in the dip di dip di dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me. Yeah. When my baby heard bom-bom-bom-bom-bom-bom-bom, every word went right into her heart. And when she heard them singing ram-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-ding-dong, she said we'd never have to part. So who put the bomb in the bomb?
That was Barry Mann, and my guests are Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Well, you know what I found interesting? Like, three of the most important women songwriters of the early rock and roll era, you, Ellie Greenwich, and Carole King, were all married to their songwriting partners. Do you feel
and we are the only ones who are still married.
Yeah, you're the only one of those three still married. Yes. That's right. Well, do you think that having a male partner was helpful, I don't mean artistically, but just in terms of getting the kind of business respect that you needed to, because there was a man there. So, like, for somebody who might only respect a man in a business relationship, there was a man to deal with.
You know, I never really thought about it, but I have a feeling that if Carole and I had written something great together, we would have gotten a great record.
Mm-hmm.
We just never, when we wrote together, we were never really serious enough to bear down and do it right. We'd kind of get sidetracked, but we did have a few records together, and I never felt that it stood in the way at all of getting a recording.
So what's the secret to your marriage? Why did your marriage and songwriting partnership last when your two friends, Carole King and Jerry Goffin, and Ellie Greenwich and
Jeff Barry,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Why their relationships broke up?
I think that it's a certain amount of tenacity and stubbornness and mm-hmm. hanging on through everything. And I also think that our neuroses happen to mesh in a very good way.
That's true, yeah. I also think that underneath it, we're really friends. And also, I really think that our songwriting is something that holds us together. And probably most marriages, you know, people who are in the same field probably have a lot of problems because of it, but I think it helped our marriage a lot. It's so much in common.
Back in the early 60s when you started writing near the Brill Building, you had, an office in a high-rise building, mm-hmm. and you'd come to work each day and sit down in your office and write tunes.
Not all the, sometimes we would be writing at home, too.
Yeah?
It was very half and half, yeah.
So
yeah.
What was your office like? Did it have, like, a typewriter and a piano in it?
It just had a piano and a mm-hmm. bench and a chair.
That was it.
And an ashtray.
Yeah, and they give us stale bread every once in a while.
But, you know, the great thing about coming in to write was that you heard what everybody else was doing because the walls were quite thin. And so we would hear what Goffin and King were pounding out in the cubicle next to us. And it was always inspirational, and it was always, it really kind of fed your creative hungers. And, you know, now when everybody has their own home studio and we're all kind of isolated, you really have to make an effort to get that input.
Wasn't it distracting to hear other people writing?
No,
not really. It just played louder. That's all.
Right. Now, did you compete with each other about whose song the Drifters would do? Like,
oh.
You know?
Oh, incredible. Absolutely.
Oh, we mm-hmm. was very competitive.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was that process like? How would you try to get the Drifters your song instead of letting Carole King get the next one with them?
Well, we really didn't have control over that. Our publisher would have us all writing for example, the Drifters, and then he would go over and pitch all the songs. That was Don Kirshner, or somebody who worked for him.
Who was a great publisher. He was an incredible salesman.
And so we would just be sitting out waiting to hear the verdict, you know.
It got so powerful in that period that Donnie did in that publishing company that, say the Drifters were up, and Donnie would play him a song, and they would love the song.
And he would say, "You can only have it if my publishing company gets the B-side also,
right.
You know, or gets the next single." Or
and they and record some record companies would give into that because you know
they wanted the song so bad.
That's right, and they knew that we were writing so prolifically that they'd always get another good song from us.
Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. They've been married and writing songs together for about 40 years. They're now appearing on stage in They Wrote That, performing their own compositions, songs such as You've Lost That Love and Feeling, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and On Broadway. Their stage show is in previews off Broadway and opens next month.
Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too. And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do.
What picture you see?
When you're hugging with your baby, last row in the balcony. Well, that's Technicolor and the CinemaScope.
Coming up, a review of the new Robert Altman film, The Company. This is Fresh Air. The director Robert Altman has made many movies with large and well-choreographed ensembles, from MASH in Nashville to his 2001 hit Gosford Park. But The Company is his first full-scale dance film. It features the dancers and choreographers of the Joffrey Ballet of Chicago, along with the actress Neve Campbell, who co-produced the movie and plays an up-and-coming principal dancer. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Robert Altman's The Company opened in New York and Los Angeles on Christmas Day and has been slowly arriving in other cities, a late and happy gift for lovers of dance, of movies, and of the work of this great American director, who's at the top of his game at the age of 78. It features some of the most fluid ballet sequences ever filmed, and the drama around them is so subtle that this could be a fly-on-the-wall documentary. But there is a theme here. It's that the life of professional ballet dancers will always be in flux, that their bodies are destined to fail them eventually, that even their triumphs are freighted with potential disaster. Every number in The Company is double-edged, at once sublime and scary. I risk doing the film a disservice by stating that theme so baldly. You could miss it and still love the movie, love it for the sculpted bodies and the fleetness of the camera. Altman moves with seeming randomness from the stage to the rehearsal room to the offices of the capricious artistic director, Alberto Antonelli, who's played by Malcolm McDowell in a hilarious homage to Joffrey Ballet co-founder Gerald Arpino. We watch the Joffrey dancers get picked or dropped from performances, get praised or lectured by choreographers. We see them break up and fall in love. We see them standing in the wings, on crutches and in casts, watching the stage. There's no real star turn. The Company is the star. But the project was initiated by Neve Campbell, who was a dancer before she found fame in TV and movies. She plays Rye, short for Ryan, a dancer who seems on the threshold of stardom, but who falls in love with someone outside the company, a young chef played by James Franco. That sounds like a cliched scenario, but Altman and screenwriter Barbara Turner have snipped out all the conventionally dramatic moments, leaving viewers to fill in the blanks. There's a sphere of privacy here that would be annoying in a different kind of film, but I came to love the absence of histrionics and Altman's refusal to linger a beat longer than necessary. The only non-dancing figure who holds the screen for any time is McDowell's Antonelli, who calls his dancers babies, and when they have his attention, prizes them. But that attention is hard won, and he can seem creepy in his indifference to the risks his performers take. You get a sense of his style from how he breaks into a rehearsal.
Hold it a minute, hold it a minute.
Okay,
what happened? I mean, you're all so pretty. You know how I hate pretty. Now, come on, I mean, lift thighs. Lift up, not so loady. And when you make those exits, you know, you hit the wall. I want you to move out and hit the wall. You're not doing that. You're looking like you've got a load in your pants. But I love you all. You're great, okay? You're great. Come on, okay.
He loves his babies, yes. But when they're injured, he moves on in businesslike fashion, a solipsistic god indeed. The film itself can seem detached, too. But its emotion is sublimated. The feeling is in the dance. It's in the astonishing number tensile involvement, with its ribbons forming geometric shapes amid the dancer's sculpted limbs, or the intensely erotic pas de deux by Campbell and Domingo Rubio to a chamber music version of My Funny Valentine, which is heard throughout the movie in renditions by Elvis Costello, Chet Baker, and others. That pas de deux happens at an outdoor benefit, with a thunderstorm approaching. And everything about it, both the sex and the danger, is thrillingly heightened. Altman is often thought of as having a loose, scruffy frame, but he proves in The Company that his looseness is deceptive. His camera is always in the exact right place, and he doesn't chop up the movements like those Cuisinart musicals Chicago and Moulin Rouge. Altman lets you gaze on these dancers' silhouettes. He isolates pieces of their bodies only for emphasis, and then only briefly. He finds the ideal vantage for ogling some of the world's most beautiful athletes. Neve Campbell got back in shape after 10 years off point for this movie. She's not quite as ethereal as some of the other dancers, but she has such long, shapely limbs and such a gorgeous urchin's face that it doesn't matter. More important, she shows in The Company what she loved about ballet and why she had to leave it. This might be the most poetically suggestive dance movie ever made.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. You look so laughable, unphotographable, but you're my favorite. Favorite work of art is your figure.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. may now be one of the world's largest importers of sex slaves, underage girls and boys smuggled into the U.S. from Mexico. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Landesman, who spent 4 months investigating the story for the New York Times Magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.